They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining me on the Commons today is Bill Davis, because Bill is a wonderful friend, and he always has so many thoughts and ideas of what's going on. So we're just going to find out basically what's going on in the world in general. With governments, with HOAs, with anything and everyone. So, Bill, thank you so much. It is always a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you, Sue. It's a pleasure to be on again, and I hope I've had enough interesting things in the intervening time period to contribute to today's show.
Well, what I love about having you on is that you seem to either somehow attract all of these weird cases or
trouble.
You just scratch away at the surface to discover what's going on underneath. And it sort of reminds me a little bit of The Association, a book by Bentley Little that's going to be reissued. I just heard from him. And, but he talked about these board members and their skins cracked and you had all this black ooze coming out of it. And that's kind of what happens with some of your cases. You sort of scratch away at the surface and you find all kinds of neat stuff there that makes for a really good and interesting story.
Well, thanks. I guess it's just coincidence. Some of these things just sort of walk through the door.
What do you have now? Do you have anything to tell us?
Well, I have, I guess one might be of interest to people that vicariously enjoy other people, going after HOAs and wanting to do them the same themselves, I guess. I have one case where the HOA sued my client three times since 2009. Each time the HOAs talked about settling or something like that, my clients had to hire an attorney. It wasn't me in all the prior cases. And at one point, even hired the mayor of another city around here, who was an attorney, also the mayor, knew a lot of people, try and get the matter resolved. The HOA then drops the lawsuit and kind of goes away for a few years. Well, they've tried foreclosing on him now three times, claiming he owes all this money, which it's not a large sum of money. It was on the order of hundreds of dollars. It started out around $80 or something like that. And the last time they filed the foreclosure suit was they filed two in the last couple of years. The previous one, not only were they able to prove that they had a lien of any kind on his property or the ability to pay assessments, but the judge that was deciding that case, that was the last case he decided that year in office. He's, quote, retired from elected office. He's now a chief administrative judge over a larger region of Texas that handles administrative matters in the district courts. And he found that they didn't prove their case. And the argument of the HOA attorney was, well, it's an HOA and everybody knows an HOA has a lien. That's not proving your case. Yeah. Then she tried charging $12,000 to my client for her failed proceeding, which there's no way that that proceeding would have cost that much money. Okay, so that was that case. They then filed another case in 2016. And when you called me today for our discussion, I was actually composing a curt email to opposing counsel in that case because we refrain from filing counterclaims. This is something people need to be aware of. A lot of times, your initial thought as an attorney or as an advocate for your client is to hit back. You know, if your client gets sued, hit back, go after the HOA. You have to be aware that this is a multi-layered beast with several different angles. You have to be careful of the claim you file because if you assert a counterclaim, it's going to allow them to file a claim with their insurance carrier, and that turns around and provides fuel for the fire to pay for their counsel to continue to harass and terrorize your client. So you have to be careful, if you can, about what you might bring down on your client.
Very clever.
Right, if you do something like that. Very clever. And so you may need to change the way you would have cast the cause of action so that it's a declaratory judgment, which is not necessarily covered, or let's say the insurance carrier can issue a letter of reservation of rights, meaning that the HOA may not get the cost of its defense paid for or any judgment against it. And, you know, because otherwise it's easy for them to spend other people's money. Oh, yeah, insurance has got it. Let's just go run this guy to the ground. That's their attitude. Well, we refrained from filing counterclaims because we did not want to trigger and my guy just wanted to leave this place. It's ugly. And for over a year, they've played games with, let's go to mediation. Okay, we go to mediation, incur the cost of that, except they send attorneys that tell us when we get there that they're not authorized to settle on behalf of their client, they don't know anything about the case, and they're not prepared to mediate. Well, that particular program was one sponsored at the cost in terms of the mediator and the facilities of the court system. And in order to get into that mediation program, when you file the application, it has to be agreed to by both parties. Of course, we supported it. And you have to agree that parties with authority to settle will show up. You mediate in good faith and that you're prepared to settle. So, you know, the fact that they would even go through this process, it was just absolutely bad faith. They assured us at the mediation that they would get on this immediately, even though that they didn't know anything about it. We talked for a while, talked about history, moved on. Well, about a week later, I hadn't heard anything from these guys, so I call them up, and the attorney I talked to says, oh, we're no longer handling this case. Not meaning the firm, meaning those particular attorneys. Still attorneys at the firm are handling it. So, but they never bothered to follow up with me and say, hey, I won't be getting in touch with you, someone else will. I call the chief of their division. Oh, we're going to follow up on this immediately. Nothing. It gets assigned to other attorneys. I talk to them. This kind of nonsense. Well, a year of this, and I got a letter last week from opposing counsel indicating that they non-suited the case, which means that they're dropping their lawsuit. They couldn't have done that if I had counterclaims, but it was, in this particular case, I don't think it was a good idea to necessarily have counterclaims because it would have just fueled this law firm to continue this bad practice for a while. And we're in the 30-day period now. I'm preparing a sanction letter to go to the court with about the tactics of this firm and what they did for the past year, and I want them to have to pay sanctions for my client who was forced through this a third time, no resolution of the case, no resolution of the claims, and they want an opportunity to do it again. And they did all this with the mediation program, and those attorneys signed their names to the mediation application. They're on the hook with the court for their failure to attend the mediation or to mediate in good faith or bring the right people to the mediation, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to have to file that type of thing. And yes, as much as I'd like to go after the HOA, it also hurts. It also helps when you go punish their soldiers engaging that kind of practice. And I think I can get punishment for this because this was just, even the mediator, typically mediation is protected or, you know, you can't disclose necessarily what happened there. But our position is no mediation actually took place because they didn't present the people here. And I can't have the mediator, testify to the fact that, you know, they did not show up with anybody. No mediation took place. None of the, you know, people that were supposed to were there. No, you know, it's just ridiculous. So that's one. I have another one.
Bill, before we move on to the next one, I have a couple of questions for you. Number one, what does it cost to go to mediation?
Well, in that particular case, the mediator fee was not at our cost. I mean, we still had attorney time, travel, and even the cost of travel, because it was 60 miles, you know, to the courthouse, which is 120 miles round trip, and the time lost of doing all that type of stuff. And my client came from an even further distance. That particular program is a program that I think it's a very good one. The county puts on twice a year, the district court system does. It's called Settlement Week, where the court system pays and provides facilities and hires mediators to attempt to get a bunch of cases mediated so that they're off the court dockets. So that's not the normal system. A regular one where the parties have to go to mediation beforehand, we're looking at $1,000 or more per party for a half day and approximately $2,000 per party or more for a full day. And when I say per party, if there's 15, you know, if there's 15 defendants that are homeowners that are all on one side, the mediator doesn't charge each one of them $2,000. Yeah, it's really per side is probably a better way of putting it. So, but yeah, and you have to pay that, and that's really hard on the homeowners, particularly when these guys have no intention of, you know, operating in good faith. And so, we have another one where we're supposed to go to mediation soon.
Before we get to that, malpractice, with what this law firm has done, it sounds like malpractice to me, who's not a lawyer.
Well, that's between them and their client, which is the HOA, which, of course, operates only through its agents. So, a homeowner in this state has no cause of action derivatively for a nonprofit corporation. So you can't, if you're a homeowner, you can't really go after board members or the attorneys of the organization or anything like that for, say, a breach of fiduciary duty or malpractice, because that, at least not with respect to HOAs, because that cause of action belongs to the HOA, which is pretty much run by the attorney, the aligned manager, and often, I know the industry says something else, the buck stops with the board. The reality is that most of these are run by the attorneys and the management company. The board's almost they're a warm body to approve
puppets.
Of what the management company's doing. Huh?
They're puppets. The board members are basically puppets.
Right.
Now, I was just wondering if this behavior would warrant malpractice, because that sounds absolutely horrific.
Well,
their behavior sounds... Yeah.
Right. The question is, what damage did their client suffer? You know, malpractice is going to require that they did something negligently and their client suffered negligently or perhaps intentionally, and their client suffered. But, I mean, what damages has their client suffered? You could argue that it hasn't collected assessments. Of course, our position is less than just a moment for what the issue was in this case. There was an HOA created by a developer over a parcel of land at one point in time. The restrictive covenants that the developer put into place expressly provided that there had to be a vote of the HOA to be extended over additional land that the developer might add. And it required a vote of all the members of the HOA, not just the developer, which was actually kind of unusual. That developer went under. The property was sold, I think, like an FSLIC type of thing, a receivership. And a subsequent developer came in that had no claim to the powers or rights of the previous developer. They were simply another developer. They just announced they were adding all this additional property, but there was never any, you know, election by the members of the HOA to extend the HOA and the lien powers over to the added property. And the reason this is important is because, yes, the developer might be able to impose restrictions, but the existing restrictions in the first part prohibited the HOA, that HOA, from being extended without a vote of those homeowners. And so we asked for copies of any proof that the, you know, vote ever took place, or, you know, there's certainly nothing recorded as an effect. And their position had been, oh, we only have to keep records for 7 years. It's like, no, that's kind of like saying we have a contract and we only have to keep it around for record retention purposes for 7 years. If you want to enforce it, you better have a copy of it. I mean, that was just an absurd argument for them to make, especially if you're going to claim you have a lien over somebody's property, right? And so all this time, they've never been able to prove that. And the reason this is important, the management company lady actually started crying in court. And I realized she was one of their witnesses because she was claiming how much, you know, that he owed this money. And we, you know, pointed out that, well, to who and based upon what. And then, you know, we kind of realized what her concern was. This is actually a six-phase development. It's fairly large. And the HOA really only exists on phase one. What she was going to be losing out on was all the resale certificate fees and transfer fees she was collecting as windfalls from five phases of this development. Every homeowner in there was forced to have to pay her firm or her money every time they sold a house. She's not a realtor. She's not a real estate agent. She holds no license with the state, and she's getting a rent-seeking, you know, type of behavior that these companies, management companies engage in, where they're extracting a cut of every property sale in the neighborhood, even though they've got nothing at stake, no investment, they don't own any of the property, you know, this, and they don't provide any service to the homeowner. And they're not, the homeowners aren't their clients, they're the victims. Yeah. And so that's what we believe that she was concerned she was going to lose out on, and then she might actually have to refund all this money that she had taken. But at any rate, that's that case.
Okay.
The other
Go on.
Case
yeah.
is this ongoing phony HOA case. I think I've mentioned it before.
Oh, yeah.
this has happened a lot all over the country, and there's multiple examples, even in the jurisdiction I live in, where the HOA kind of goes under, and in some cases, people deliberately want it to go under. In others, it may be accidental. But it doesn't matter. If it was all that important, people would have been taking care of it, and that wasn't the case. This HOA went under in 1994. It was originally created because this was an unincorporated area of the county. A developer owns about 80 acres adjacent to another 700 acres approximately. Well, about 680 acres approximately. And he wanted to have roads in the subdivision and to find a way to pay for the roads and to maintain them. Well, he proposed an HOA. He got the agreement of the other landowners in the area. At least we're assuming he did because they filed documents. We don't know right now if it met statutory requirements because that's not the issue in the case. But they, you know, created the HOA in order to collect and fund the installation and maintenance of the roads. The following year, this was 1984, the following year, they filed a petition with the county to create a special roads district to pay for it. The special, which is a political subdivision of the state, so the special roads district was formed over this geographic territory, and now all these people were subjected to taxes, special taxes that were specific to and dedicated to paying off, basically the county got bonds to put in the roads, and the people that live in this district were taxed, or the owned property in this district were taxed to pay off those bonds over a 15-year period. But the bottom line is now the whole purpose for the HOA, about a year after it was implemented, is gone. It's not needed there anymore. The roads were, the bonds were all paid off on the roads. The developer let the HOA lapse in 1994. Move forward, and it was terminated by the state. Move forward to 2002, where some nutcases who were just so desperate for control, you could just, I mean, there are truth study in antisocial disorders. I don't know a better way to put it. I had to learn that term when I was trying to understand the behavior of these individuals. It is important to understand why or how people might react to different things in many cases, and I find it particularly so in these HOA cases. I do believe a number of these board members or the people attracted to those positions are people that have, I wouldn't say suffer from antisocial disorder. I think everyone else suffers from their antisocial disorder. But these people just have an incredible desire to cause harm or to control other people. And the HOA is just a great platform for them. Well, they discovered that after they sued somebody, that the HOA, and they got, you know, hoisted by the tard, that they discovered that the HOA had gone under. So what did they try to do? They tried to kind of cover it up, didn't mention it to anybody else in the subdivision, spent a lot of money on that lawsuit of other people's money. They formed a total of three different organizations in the 2000 and 2002 timeframe trying to give the appearance that it was the HOA. The last one they formed was in 2002, brand new corporation formed in 2002. They didn't tell anybody this. They used the same name or very similar name as the original one set forth in the deed restrictions, and then just kind of pass it off as the original HOA from the deed restrictions from 20 years prior. And, of course, it couldn't have been the same entity. It couldn't have been because those restrictions mentioned an incorporated entity by name, and such an entity existed. And this entity was created 20 years later, and it is not the same entity. So it's not this, you know, it's not the entity in the deed restrictions. So they sued my client. We found out that this entity is not the HOA. We call it the FOA, the phony HOA. And it has been filing lawsuits, recording liens, and doing all sorts of collecting money every time somebody tries to sell their house, threatens people. It's been doing this for years. They sued my clients kind of out of the blue. We figured out what was going on, and we counterclaimed against them. A judge has already told them that they're not the HOA. They're going to have an election. The other side has desperately been trying to – their idea of a settlement is that we need to – they need to be able to walk my client's property and look for problems. It's like, shouldn't you have had an idea of what, you know, the alleged complaint was before you filed a lawsuit against my client claiming they were in violation of something? I mean, we're not going to give you an open – season to go walk around on private property to look for problems. You know, no. If you didn't have a claim at the time you filed a lawsuit, your claims need to go away. But they expect us to simply drop our claim seeking a determination that they're not the HOA. And they call that a walk away. And it's not a walk away because it essentially leaves unresolved whether or not this organization has a lien, whether it can collect money from my clients, whether my clients must go to it for or its board members for approval for everything, you know, and that's not a walk away. That's a, we want you to surrender to not jeopardize our kingdom. And they're so desperate to preserve this. They've done nothing. And I know I'm long winded here, but they've sent out all these communications. They put up a web page that says, you know, this organization was formed to enforce the deed restrictions, which is probably true. Immediately below that, they say, according to the deed restrictions, the Property Owners Association has the following powers, and it lists a number. Well, it's true the deed restrictions list those powers for a Property Owners Association. Of course, some of those have been invalidated by later law. But the implication that they've tried to, you know, cause you to draw is that the first named entity is the one that is the Property Owners Association under the restrictive covenants, and it isn't. And this was very artfully done. So they knew, you know, you can tell and you realize what's happened, that this was an intentional misrepresentation designed to mislead. They do the same thing with closings. And I look at this and go, these people, they're defrauding buyers, sellers, title companies, insurance companies, and lenders. This is not a trivial matter. These people should be, you know, they should get a trial and a fair hearing and convicted and put in jail. This is really a criminal enterprise, and under the pretext of preserving property values. At any rate,
they're a crime family, Bill.
What's that?
They're a crime family.
It is a crime family, and the sad thing is it's being led by an attorney right now who sends out these letters, and I think this is one of the things we're going to get to, operating off of fear. They proclaim, oh, they have to have an HOA. Well, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but that doesn't make this entity the HOA. And, you know, talk about how they've protected homeowners and how they've protected their property values. I can't think of something that's been a bigger drag to all the people there. These folks recently, you know, after we counterclaimed, they were nervous about collecting money from people. And recently, we tried moving it for trial because this has been going for 4 years. We're tired of it, and we needed to set a trial. We wanted a trial. It didn't hurt them to sit there and have the issue unresolved. We wanted a trial date to get the issue resolved for my clients. They're the property owners, not the HOA. So we started setting about to get a trial date, which, of course, means they're going to have to spend money with their attorney to represent them at trial. And the first thing that they did was send out a scare letter demanding 2 years' worth of assessments from everybody, saying that there's going to be an election before the end of the year, which is long before. They haven't had one in 2 years, and the normal time frame is third weekend in March, but now suddenly they're going to have one before the end of the year. This letter came out December the 9th, told everybody that they had until the 18th to submit any nominations they were going to submit. Of course, the letters were mailed, so people didn't find out till days later. And it's almost no time. And they're going to have an election before the end of the year. Oh, and by the way, the sitting board members and architectural committee members have nominated themselves for this, you know, for this end of year unusual election. And I look at it as they're just trying to create the appearance that they, you know, are affirming that they're in control, because this isn't really an election by any stretch of the imagination. But the letter gives all the, it gives a number of false examples where they've literally just made up events that didn't happen, saying that they protected people from that. And more recently, they claim that they're protecting people from developments going on, you know, preventing commercial establishments from going on the subdivision, which also isn't the truth. So what do? They go on the attack to try to prevent. This is a rural area. Keep in mind, it's not within any city limits. It fronts a ranch road, which is it's almost like a highway. And there's no light in the subdivision, and there's an entrance into the subdivision off this ranch road. Well, all the property fronting the subdivision, it's considered part of the subdivision, but not subject to the deed restrictions. And the deed restrictions actually provide that they don't apply to lots, you know, A through X and, you know, Y through Z type of a thing. Those lots are all designated as commercial lots, and they're not subject to the deed restrictions. So you got this attorney up there claiming he's going to protect people from whatever's going to be built up there based upon what? Their organization, the deed restrictions specifically exclude them. If you want to play the everyone knew it when you moved in game, well, everyone knew it when you moved in that those properties weren't subject to the deed restrictions, and you've got no right to try and impose your view of what should be there on those properties. Last night, I went to this to go see what these clowns were going to claim was their authority and everything. An application for a convenience store on one of those commercial lots, as well as a food court made up of trailers, which is kind of a new fad going around here and probably lots of other places, where a little bitty parcel of land are opened up and a bunch of food trailers come in to serve a variety of foods at different times of the day. And so that was going to go in there. Well, he's created this huge scare factor and said that was prohibited and everything else. Sure, it's not prohibited. It's not prohibited under the deed restrictions. It's a perfectly legitimate business in the county, which is where this is. And it's worse than a NIMBY. It's a NIMBY that actually thinks that they have personal authority to dictate what's going to go over there. I was just appalled at watching this proceeding and how these people behave, thinking that they should have a right to dictate that another property owner should be forced to leave it as you know, green land or brown land at this time of the year, so these people didn't have to look at something else. If you went into the subdivision, I think it's a disgrace that everyone has to look at the houses.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and their claim, it's one of those where we're better than everybody else, except when you actually look at their, what they claim to be protecting, it's somewhat suspect. But I don't know what else to add to that. But that's what's going on. We're going to go to trial on that. We do expect to prevail on that. Trial has forced us to, one of the prerequisites here is you have to go to mediation before trial. So we're working to get the mediation date set. And, you know, all the others, there are things that we can compromise on and intend to work in good faith to settle on, but there's certain fundamentals that are not subject to compromise. They're not an HOA, and they don't have the authority to impose a lien. And if you were to believe them, then just anybody, I mean, we could go out and form an organization and proclaim that we're entitled to enforce the deed restrictions, which we could do as an organization, but that doesn't mean that we are the entity under those deed restrictions that's entitled to collect monies and secured with a lien on everybody else's property out there. That's just an incredible claim by these people. So
we have created such a mess that some people just assume because they exist that they have to exist, or that they exist everywhere, that they're needed. They're not. And I think we need to start educating people about what they have and whether there's any good that comes out of these, because clearly there really isn't.
Right. Well, a funny that happened on this is, you know, this subdivision has restrictions to prohibit businesses. And I pointed out, what else do you call this organization but a business? And it's a for-profit business because it provides no services to the homeowner. There's no common amenities. The roads are public roads. There's literally nothing that they pay for except the attorney for the organization and insurance for the board members. That's the two costs this thing has. Now, if that isn't a self, the bad kind of self-sustaining, badness, where your purpose for existence, you exist, therefore, so you must exist in order to collect insurance money to insure yourself and to collect money to pay an attorney to insure your existence. To what end? It's done nothing but cause extreme financial harm to a number of people in the subdivision. They've done it to literally run people out of the neighborhood who simply couldn't afford to defend themselves, is what it came down to, which is the subject of one of the other issues we talked about. And really, in this case, the funny thing is there's a prohibition against businesses. What do you call this thing other than a criminal enterprise that if any business in the subdivision should be shut down, it's this one, you know?
Bill, I always say that you're one of the most creative attorneys I know out there. I really hope that you're going to argue that case when you get to court, because I like the idea that they are a business. I like the way you've styled that. And if, you know, use their words and use their covenants against them. If this is, you know, if businesses are not allowed, then you've got to shut down and go away.
What?
Can you do that? I mean,
yeah, we intend to. I mean, I've already had this argument with their counsel outside of the, you know, judge's courtroom previously, and that's where we're going to go with it. It's like, my gosh.
I love
really
it. Forced
to talk about arbitrary and capricious, you know.
I love it.
You are the business, and you're not a legal one, and you operate in the subdivision, and, you know, and in terms of people being deadbeats, here's the biggest deadbeat in the world. It shakes down people for money and gets absolutely nothing in return.
I love it.
Everybody's paying this thing. It is a big deadbeat. So we're trying to free the people there. We're going to succeed. I'm confident of that. The frustrating part is the amount of time it's taken, but they have been counting on, just wearing down individuals who can't hang in there because of the length of time and, you know, typically financial resources and things like that. Whereas the individuals behind the organization, the attorney, the board members, do not personally suffer in any way. Their egos may suffer when they lose, but they're not on the hook for the money. Their property isn't. They should be. I agree. It's horrific. It's horrific that you have certain immunities for, quote, they call it charitable immunity. These people are not candy stripers. They are not hospital, altruistic, you know, caretakers. They are predators that, you know, are using this as a cover under the pretext of doing good. They're not doing good. And it's so apparent. But, yeah, we're plodding along. And what's caused the uproar with them is that we got tired of waiting and started moving this towards a certain trial date. And now that's something that they just don't want. It's better. They want it to just sit and hopefully the, you know, their open heart clients will like pass away, try to move or something like that. You know, they're literally holding their house hostage because they can't refinance. They can't sell. They can't do anything else while this is going on. And unfortunately, that's like tactic number one in these HOA cases is the victim, is they try to impose extreme financial harm on the victim at the outset. And
that should be illegal, Bill. That should be absolutely illegal.
They should be forced to have to pay for that. But, you know, unfortunately, we keep promoting these things, if not directly, then at least indirectly through planning policies and everything else. It's horrible.
So we come on here. You're one of the few people, and it's interesting because the more I talk to people now, the longer that people have been around, more and more people are saying, I agree with you, Sue, you can't fix these. Because before, everybody was saying, well, we need the laws and we're going to put this law and we're going to, and, you know, they do that and they've been doing it for years and nothing ever really changes.
Well, and I think it may be a generational thing because I know we weren't really exposed to it. I didn't realize it growing up that we actually lived in one that there was, you know, that there was actually an HOA there. I wouldn't have known what that was or anything else. But apparently, they actually wrote down all their minutes. Anyone could have access to the records, which, of course, is a big game the industry plays now. Oh, no, we're going to pretend we're going to give you access. We actually put in these documents you have access, but we're going to deny you access and force you to go to court. And even then, we're still not going to give you access to records. You know, all this stuff was very open. But there's definitely been a change and a much more, and people that have experienced it. And I think Dr. Solomon had talked about the kids of people who had been abused by HOAs or had done this, and they weren't going to be as accepting in many cases of an HOA or HOA property. And I do think there's more of that, but there's also a lot of the drones that have just been trained to, you know, be obedient, do what you're told, obedient.
That's scary.
Yeah, while the industry people suck every last dime out of their out of their property.
I've always been concerned about the kids, and I was the one who kept asking Gary about it. And I said, you know, what about the kids? I mean, I really worry about kids growing up in this environment. And I've heard from parents who are afraid of going home. They're afraid of leaving the house. They won't get the mail. They won't answer the door. They won't answer the phone. Just in case it's the HOA, how does that raise your family, your kids, if they watch you just cower in terror?
Right, or your performance at work or in life in general. It's like I think it obviously doesn't affect everyone that way, but I think it affects a significantly large number of people that way. And there hasn't been an adequate examination of just what kind of an impact that is health-wise or work-wise. And I'm pretty sure that a number of the shootings across the country or, you know, violent things that have occurred in some of these places are due to conflicts between, you know, an involuntary member and the administration of the HOA. But, you know, because it hits too close to home, it literally hits you at home.
Well, there was the story from, you had the Arizona shooting where they went in and shut up the board members because the board members decided that, and I don't remember the guy's name,
Richard Glass.
Something like that. That they decided his trees and bushes weren't trimmed properly, whatever that is.
Right.
So they sent someone on board to trim them. Then you had the other guy in Illinois. When he came home from work, he was, some kind of a European, came home from work and found all his stuff on the common, from his condo. All of his private property had been thrown on the lawn with a police tape around it. So he took his gun and went and shot the secretary who had been after him.
He killed him.
Yeah, killed her and her girlfriend as well.
One of the Arizona stories also was the board didn't like the girlfriend of an elderly gentleman there, and they moved the minimum age up in order to make her, run afoul of their new age limits, and then were demanding that she, leave the property, and that's what caused that whole. That was one of the items that caused that whole fiasco. But no, I know, and there was another one in, I believe, Utah, where the board member and his buddy drove around in a car with guns. You know, it's like we're in charge, we're monitoring what's going on around here. They stepped out to confront another homeowner who shot one of them, and the guy that was shot, unfortunately, was kind of a somewhat innocent in the thing. He was actually the more reasonable person of the whole thing. But why are you driving around, acting like you're the police? And clearly you're trying to assert dominance over everybody out there and, displaying guns and stuff like this. And you're the big bad guy under the pretext that they're protecting other people. They weren't. They were out there to intimidate people is what they were doing. And then one of them got seriously injured and was I don't know if he remained paralyzed, but I recall that when he was shot, he was paralyzed. And
you had the guy, what, in Alabama or someplace down south, and he ended up committing suicide. He went and shot someone. But the thing is, you put these people in a position of power, they think they're invincible. They think they're God. They bully people. They're abusive. And so when somebody gets so fed up, the only way they can protect themselves is to shoot these people?
Right. Well, and systemically, it's all wrong. A homeowner can't really get insurance against these HOAs, or even for a lawsuit from the HOA, typically. But the HOA can purchase insurance for defense against claims by the homeowner. So, that's kind of problematic from a system type of approach. And it creates an outcome that shouldn't occur because one side has, more funds. That's by design. So that the HOA in those cases tends to win not because it was correct, but because it out-resources the victim early on. And, of course, that's the game a bunch of these guys are playing and gals. But, and then the HOAs are being forced into new developments either by the local government, which wants them, and even if the local government didn't, the developer wants, absolute power over everybody in there and every property it's sold. It's not really willing to release control of that property, and that's one of the, other problems with the HOA. It's kind of a restraint on the alienability because the developer sells the property, but the buyer is stuck with the developer's continued, almost absolute control over the property until such time as the developer wants to give it away. That's not really selling the property. It's not really conveying the property to the homeowner.
Bill, I can understand that to a certain extent because they're investing a lot of money in there, but a lot of states have enacted legislation that severs the developer's power or its relationship with the association after so many years or after whatever. I think it ought to be a time limit because quite often they will maintain. Sometimes it'll be until 75% of properties have been sold or whatever. So they'll maintain 25% for themselves and never get to that 75%.
Right. Or what, another thing that commonly happens is they will, since they have the power to unilaterally amend, as they approach that threshold, they will either add additional property. Okay, so now that changes the math again. Or they'll simply amend the restrictive covenants to change the threshold. You know, like instead of 75%, it'll be so long as you own one lot. Or if it's a voting threshold, they'll give themselves a voting multiplier that says you get more votes depending upon who you are on a lot as opposed to the, you know, the your actual ownership of lots. So I've seen plenty of them that, you know, the homeowners get one vote and the developer gets, you know, 100 and something votes to ensure that the developer can never be overruled, even when the period of developer control has ended. It's pretty outrageous.
These are laws, and the law says that if you, Mr. Developer, if you're going to build 100 homes, once you've reached 75, you have relinquished all control over that. Now, the governing documents, that there's going to be a declaration, the governing documents can protect the properties while the developer is working there, but that those covenants will expire once he's reached that 75%, so that it's not hanging over everybody's head ad nauseum. There has to come, there has to be an end. It's not his decision. It's, you know, and the homeowners should decide if they even want an HOA, and they ought to vote on it. And I think that to impose something so horrible on anybody, they would have to have a supermajority. Like 95% say yes. None of this, you know, just a simple majority baloney. Just, you know, cut it off. So you can still protect and achieve what the developer wants, but you don't have to force this down people's throats forever and ever.
Right. And it's, at some point, it's not, you know, people talk about preserving the look and feel, and it's like, you're selling the land. There's not an obligation to keep somebody else's view, which, by the way, was only put there. It's like they were an artist. It was put there to sell the lot based upon existing market conditions and the fads that were in at the time. And those things change. People need the ability to change. And I'm just kind of rambling here, but there's, you know, this idea that you can only I just think that all these things shouldn't be subject to, well, you can only do that if at least 51% or more, or maybe 75% of people approve of it. It's absolute oppression of the, say, 10% or so. I understand that psychologically you have to have at least 10% to get some kind of movement going that has a chance of, you know, capturing the majority. But instead, the minority is extremely oppressed in these things. So, you know, oh, no, you can only have colors that are dictated by, I like to use the example because this is what it is everywhere I've seen, that a, you know, 65-year-old white woman would choose for her.
But the thing is, Bill, you know, we've seen this happen over and over again. I mean, if you go in and you walk into a house that's for sale, you walk into the kitchen and you've got Aqua appliances. I mean, it's dated, right? You go, oh, my God, there's the 60s or the 50s. I mean, who has Aqua refrigerators or yellow
avocado,
you know, avocado or Harvest Yellow or all of these things? What that screams is the 70s. It's passé. We have so many of the original HOAs here, and they come with their paint chips. It's got to be Burke Center Brown. The thing is, when buyers walk in, that's so 70s, that's so 60s, it is dated. It is dated.
Right.
But if everybody's got to have that, and the thing is that you can't get those paints anymore. They'll tell you that it has to be Martin Senauer, number so-and-so, such and such a color, and they just flat don't make
and
that
anymore. And we're going to fine you if you don't continue this losing,
But the thing is that those things devalue property. I mean, you know, it's so much nonsense.
Well, we have to continue work at destroying the myth or exposing the myth that these HOAs somehow preserve value. They don't. I do think that condos are a little bit different. It's not that I like them or support them in any way, and I'm certainly going to advise my kid to never, ever put money into a condo. But they're a creature of statute. They're not a traditional housing that had been known before that time, and they're set up a little differently. They have the same problems and more that HOAs have, but I really particularly find the HOAs to be, you know, onerous and these ridiculous requirements that and it's always fear that's used to sell it, and also the false idea that you're going to be dealing with reasonable people on the other side too, or that you might have recourse if something is denied. You don't. You have to go to court. They don't.
Even in a condominium, even in a high rise, you really and truly do not need to have an association. If you had an association, if you had mandatory payments, assessments, whatever, to maintain some of the common expenses. The thing is, you don't need the governance issues. That's got to go. If you look at Europe, you look at Paris, and you look at some of these older cities where they've got what we call a condominium. They're multi-unit, high-rise, or multi-level buildings. It's the owners who get together. It's the owners who make the decisions. It's the owners who tell the manager that, you know, we want the hallways painted this year, you need to fix the elevators. Whatever the problem is, they decide, and they decide what they're going to pay. And it's the manager who then takes the owner's direction from the owners and does it instead of the other way around. So you don't...
Right. I think I was referring to, like, we're talking about built form versus legal form. I just meant the things that are legally condominiums are kind of more problematic because it's a specific.
But you don't need the legal.
But I agree with you.
We don't need the legal. In America, we just said, oh my God, we need to have a legal form because we've got these. We're going to allow these multi-unit developments. You don't need the legal form. You really don't.
The industry folks have been busy promoting this horrendous concept in several of the countries, and I have enjoyed reading with pleasure some of the government criticisms in other countries of what's going on in these, they're often gated subdivisions there, or gated communities, as I like to call them. And they obviously don't really work anywhere.
No, they don't. I mean, and they never will. That's the point I've been trying to make, and that's one of the arguments I've had with so many people. Oh, yeah, they will if you just tweak the law. No, they won't. It goes against human nature. It goes against the grain. They will never work.
Well, and the problem is there's just not adequate. Continuing to force this thing doesn't mean people are going to like them. And I always compared it to cockroaches. People kept saying that, there's obviously there's a demand because that's why developers keep building them. No, the developers are the ones that want that kind of control. That's why they impose them. The local government has tried to impose them as a public policy that benefits the local government. But numerosity is not the same thing as popularity, and that's evidenced by cockroaches. People don't move to Houston because they like cockroaches, because they got lots of cockroaches there. That doesn't make them popular,
That's a great point.
Yeah, cockroaches, fire ants, there's a lot of them, but that doesn't mean that they're popular. That's a misnomer, marketed by the industry folks. They're extremely unpopular, and the problem is people can't find housing that isn't in them. You know, this higher density craze, I'm not for it or anything like that, but I find it interesting that – by that I mean it's not for me. Because it typically comes with even more control over individual populars.
We've given them an inch, and they're taking more than a mile.
Right. But if that's really what is selling, and if people are actually interested in that, it's the same thing you were just talking about. You're freezing these properties forever in something that doesn't survive the changes over time of what people want, what is useful to people, what's marketable and what keeps up with – you don't have to keep up with the Joneses, but I'm talking about, holding people hostage to utilities that aren't even useful anymore. Like forcing to have to pay for a telephone service when people are using cell phones and not necessarily copper wires anymore, because so many of these have these, the developer gets into this contract deal where the developer gets a kickback and the people are mandated to have to purchase services from particular vendors.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, when you go to cell phones, maybe you don't need regular copper wire phones so much, or at least it should be a choice. Same thing with
cockroaches is a great way to end the show, Bill.
Okay.
We are out of time. I thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Sue.
For
another great.
I always have fun talking to you. Thanks to everyone for joining us.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.